Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This has been a big week for anniversarial celebrations, which began with Bernal Daylight Savings Day Sunday, in which we have mandated an hour of our lives to be repaid in 6 months. Tuesday was Pi Day, 314, and also E equals MC squared Day, Einstein's 138th birthday. You might remember he was a refugee and became a U.S. citizen in 1940. Yesterday, the Ides of March, was Caesar Acupuncture Day. Today is the Finnish High Holiday celebrating St. Urho, who deported Finland's grasshopper population. And St. Patrick's Day is tomorrow. Legend is he changed Irish snakes into immigrants, with a reminder that there are at least 50,000 undocumented immigrant Irish living in the USA. Along with New York's famous St. Patrick's Day parade, which unsuccessfully attempted to ban the LGBT contingent this year, there is a rally at Riverside Church to denounce President Donald Trump's immigration ban and remind all Irish Americans they are descended from immigrants who were initially despised and harassed when they got off the boats. All proceeds from the rally will be donated to the American Civil Liberties Union. And today, March 16th, is also My Lai Day, the 49th anniversary of the massacre of Vietnamese citizens by American soldiers just after Tet, 1968. This is the war crime that defines the Vietnam War. I dedicate today's program to Ronald Ridenour, who unearthed My Lai, and to Anna Myers, an Agent Orange baby whose father died of Agent Orange from his service in Vietnam. I start with something I wrote, which most of this program, virtually all of this program, are things that I wrote. I start with my poem. I try to sum up the Vietnam War in a poem I wrote, an explanation of which takes up considerably more paper than my deconstructed haiku. But it helps to understand the poem if a little history is remembered and understood, such as that Song Mai was a large village complex in South Vietnam on the coastal plain south of the Song Trabang River and near the South China Sea. One of its hamlets was My Lai Four, a name which will bear calumny for the rest of American history. It was where a platoon from the U.S. Army's AmeriCal Division under the command of Lieutenant named Rusty Callie Kali massacred in cold blood at least 200, but probably more, Vietnamese women and children, plus a few old men found in the village on March 16, 1968. This slaughter of unarmed civilians was ostensibly in revenge for the costly Tet Offensive launched by Viet Cong and North Vietnamese Army regiments the previous month, but it also reflected Standard Operational Procedure, SOP. Though the dead at My Lai were gruesomely more numerous than other search and destroy operations, they were murdered in the same manner Vietnamese were killed all over South Vietnam by Americans, whether by infantry invasions of small villages or by the strategic slaughter by artillery and air attack. My Lai might have gone unnoticed except for a soldier who joined the AmeriCal Division at Chu Lai, which was a USMC base most of my time in Vietnam the previous year. After My Lai, and listened to the stories the soldiers told, his name was Ron Ridenour. He is dead now, and few know him by name, but he did at least two great services for the USA about Vietnam. He made the American public aware of My Lai after Congress refused to pay attention to his revelations about the massacre. And later, as a civilian reporter back in Vietnam, he broke the news about the use of the chemical defoliant Agent Orange, yet another government secret that was a tragic example of its callous short-sightedness, knowingly poisoning its own soldiers to get at an enemy. Because of Ridenour and the more known Seymour Hersh, who wrote the first My Lai story, the name My Lai is emblematic of the entire war, the more than a decade the USA spent waging an unnecessary and savage war that embodied blatant racism and virtual disregard for centuries agreed upon laws of warfare. But also the massacre at My Lai represents the random waste of lives in small brushfire conflicts conducted through clients by two superpowers in an aggressive and possibly obliterative contest for world supremacy for half a century, in each of the small wars releasing pressure that might otherwise explode into mutual nuclear annihilation, yet simultaneously cocking the trigger for just such an explosion. This is why I think my petite haiku might sum up the entire Vietnam War experience. The poem. Song Mai, my song. My Lai, my Lai. In April 1971, Rusty Calley was found guilty and confined to house arrest for about a year. He said to the court-martial board of his slap on the wrist, "You stripped me of all honor. Please, by your actions that you take here, don't strip future soldiers of their honor." But the My Lai prosecutor, Army Captain Aubrey M. Daniel III, countered Calley, saying, "What he did stripped him of his honor. It can never be honor to kill unarmed men, women, and children." And former Captain Dr. Howard Levy, a Green Beret doctor, who refused Vietnam duty for conscientious reasons, said, "I was punished for refusing to obey an order. Calley was convicted for failing to disobey one." But let's face it, both of us are scapegoats. And from there, Winter Soldiers, again, which I wrote. The unequivocal purpose of VVAW was to end the war, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and bring U.S. troops home from overseas. To that end, VVAW held two war crimes inquiries to publicly make clear the war's deception, amorality, and decimation of Vietnamese as a people and culture, but also the threat to American values the war was allegedly being fought for. The testimonies, named Winter Soldier Investigations, in contrast to Thomas Paine's jibe at Sunshine Patriots, were held in Washington, D.C. in December 1970 and Detroit, Michigan in February 1971. Winter Soldier was a response to the slaughter of Vietnamese civilians at My Lai in 1968, but only publicly revealed the previous year. The veterans hoped to show that although an army platoon had killed more people in a single place, the attitude toward Vietnamese generated by fear, racism, and revenge that led to My Lai was universal throughout Vietnam and the war. By the mandate of Nuremberg, military men and women are required to speak out against war crimes and other forms of injustice and wrongdoing within the military. It is usually next to impossible to do so without isolation and punishment while in uniform, and the great majority of those in VVAW waited until they were free of the military. Many in uniform were heartened by VVAW as a result and took a chance to speak out against Vietnam despite the risks. For most of the veterans who testified, it was the first time they had recounted their experiences in Vietnam, and for nearly all of them, it was the first opportunity they had to listen to the experiences of others who had done virtually the same things over a decade of war. The most important factor was the redundancy, the same genocidal pattern linked by men whose service in Vietnam spanned the period of American involvement. It was the first time the whole puzzle pieced itself together for each one of them, most of whom had spent not much more than a single year in country. They testified for 3 days, more than 100 vets speaking as though possessed with devils, bursting past their shaky voices. They told of genocide, psychological and physical, of forced urbanization of peasants from villages, of burning and pillaging hundreds upon hundreds of villages, of wholesale defoliation of jungles and fields, of indiscriminate bombing with napalm and high fragmentation bombs, of harassment and interdiction fire by artillery every night with no particular targets, just shooting up the countryside to instill fear and carnage, and they told of free fire zones where everything that moved was fair game to be killed, no questions asked. Even as men broke down and cried while testifying or listening, Winter Soldier emerged as a tense elaboration of American policy in Vietnam through the combined narratives of the soldiers who carried it out. But no one seemed to listen. The news media, for the most part, embargoed their testimony. What coverage they received was precarious and quietly sensational in its limited coverage, calling them alleged veterans, though all of them presented their documents of legitimacy. Detractors who attended the hearings called them phonies, cowards, and traitors. The Pentagon denied their accusations and put the burden of proof as well as guilt as specific war criminals upon the vets. Oregon Senator Mark Hatfield defied criticism and had the testimonies inserted into the congressional record. Anti-war veterans movements have been virtually unnoticed in American history. Yet that history abounds with veterans taking arms against their military masters from the very start. Former colonial veterans of the French and Indian War fought against their old army and set up a republic 2 centuries ago. The army split down the middle in 1861, and comrade fought comrade for 4 immensely bloody years until the Union was restored. Of more subtle consequence was the Whiskey Rebellion of 1795. Revolutionary War veterans banded together to protest the taxing of whiskey. Their methods were radical yet peaceful, but the new U.S. Army was sent to suppress them with force at the order of President George Washington. Confederate veterans formed armed groups after the Civil War to resist the plundering Reconstructionist, and that's a quote, governments that took up occupation in the South. An entire Southern Army division defected intact to Mexico, but dissipated before it could fight because neither Juaristas nor occupation French wanted it. The luckless ambition had been for its officers to lead a combined Confederate-Mexican army back across the border to fight Yankees again. In 1932, the Bonus Army, made up of World War I veterans, marched on Washington, D.C. to demand promised war benefits as a desperate attempt to survive the Great Depression. They built a shanty city outside the Capitol and were forcibly dispersed by the Army. A few were killed, many beaten. In World War II, an army division in Europe went on strike until some of its demands against intolerable conditions were met. The ringleaders were arrested. Following the war, almost the entire Pacific Command nearly mutinied when it was learned several army divisions as well as naval forces were to be sent to China to combat the communist forces of Mao Zedong. The mutiny was quickly averted by keeping the promise made at the start of the war that troops would be sent home when it was over. Also, after World War II, thousands of servicemen angrily protested a year-long continuation of the draft and were only appeased when they were told that new draftees would replace them and they would get home sooner as a result. There have undoubtedly been countless such revolts against the military system, however limited in scope and action, whether or not successful. With the exception of renegade officers leading military coups and setting up dictatorships, the actions of soldiers turning against their nation's military in the name of peace and anti-militarism have largely gone unknown. In that context, it would seem that the only combat veteran in Western history known to attempt the philosophical collapse of militarism was Socrates. If there has ever existed a well-researched and documented history of rebellion within military institutions objecting to militarism and the ethic of war, it has been well hidden from curious eyes. What information is known has been confined to obscure texts and memoranda. However important the specifics may be in piecing together the pattern, the greatest importance is the fact that revolt within the military machine is an enduring tradition in itself. Just as radical opposition has always existed at the core of every civil political system, so it has inside every military arm of those systems. Within this tradition of revolt can be understood both the roots and vacuum of the rebellion against the Vietnam War by a number of its veterans. The roots lie in the constant insurrection throughout military history. The vacuum exists in the suppression of that history. Vietnam veterans who opposed the war had to start from scratch with little workable knowledge of precedent in what they attempted. Yet because they were left to their own imaginations, the members of VVAW instigated the most significant revolt against war by war veterans in American history. And that was Winter Soldiers. And now I'd like to read also what I wrote, Platoon, with a quote from Oliver Stone. I think that through this award, you are really acknowledging the Vietnam veteran, and I think what you're saying is that for the first time you really understand what happened over there, and I think what you're saying is that it should never, ever in our lifetimes happen again. And that was Oliver Stone, who wrote and produced Platoon for when he won his 1987 Academy Award acceptance speech for the movie. Platoon. I spent a year in Vietnam as a U.S. Marine up around the DMZ, most of the time with infantry and reconnaissance outfits as a combat correspondent. I watched the movie Platoon when it was shown at the old Liberty Theater in Astoria 30 years ago in the spring of 1987. I sat through it quietly, as still as a lizard on a rock. I wished to feel no emotion or surprise and tried to keep constantly in mind that I was merely watching a movie, a script with actors. I did not have to fall to the floor when the shooting started or participate in any of the killing and dying. I could leave my seat at any time and go out into the lobby for popcorn or a Coke. I wanted to see Platoon because I was drawn almost irresistibly to the war in which I spent such a brief time, little less than a year, but which has remained with me since, not in the past, but always in the visceral present. I wished to see Platoon also because it was the first mainline film that made such an impression on the American perception of the Vietnam War that it became a part of the war's history. Platoon is a grunt's eye view of the war. It reaches no farther than the narrow, uninformed butchery of an infantry platoon's daily routine at war. It provides no more information for the viewer to comprehend what is occurring than the soldiers are aware of. Combat is confusion and disintegration. Surviving is every soldier's main interest. The war's political purposes are of no use to them. Out of fear, they murder in anger and destroy villages. Combat soldiers live in the now. In the next instant, they are dead, wounded, or inexplicably unscathed until the next shot or explosion. Toward the end of Platoon, I double-imaged its story with memories of my own. Only twice did tears sneak into my eyes. When the platoon torched a village after murdering a few of its inhabitants, my experience in several villages I visited, and at a soldier's response to immense attack by North Vietnamese regulars, his helpless terror at knowing that in only moments with no chance of escape, he would fight savagely and perhaps unsuccessfully for his life, filled me with familiar dread. When a black member of the platoon said that life was sweet after war, I remembered my single-minded desire to survive. Future torment and problems of readjustment were a small price to pay for life. A friend who was wounded in Vietnam and killed in a motorcycle accident in Portland used to say that anyone who lived through a war should not have to die. After the movie was over, people streamed into the lobby, grim-faced and somberly quiet. A woman who knew I'd been in Vietnam put her arms around me and quite suddenly burst into tears and walked quickly away. A man looked at me helplessly, unable to say anything. A large, solid man, a good friend who had resisted the war, put a hand on my shoulder and said sadly, "I'm sorry, man." Others who knew me nodded solemnly as they passed out into the street. Most of them were about my age, aging members of the Vietnam generation. But among them were those who were young enough to be Reagan bait. Their expressions were blank, as if they had been somewhat de-Ramboed, soberly moved by their first glimpse of what war might really be like. I was not sure if I should add Platoon to my Vietnam experience. Yet it was through this movie that people related to me as a veteran of the war. They talked to me anxiously, sadly, or out of curiosity, which I found surprising after so many years of almost everybody avoiding discussion or thought about it. The question I was asked most was if the movie was real. Was it really like that? A woman asked if the characters in A Faceless Army were so sharply defined. I was surprised by the question. My friends in Vietnam were among the most individualistic I have known, and those still alive remained that way 50 years afterward. Living routinely on the edge of terror and death has a habit of bringing out inner feelings and eccentricities. I was asked if I was affected by Platoon. I replied that I went home after watching the movie, dug a hole outside my house among some bushes, and slept in it. Reflexes, of course, outlast their necessity, as if suspecting everything afterward is illusion. Since I had been back from the war, I dropped on my belly in city intersections and other places where cars or trucks backfired or wherever firecrackers erupted. Once I threw a woman down on a sidewalk when my foot brushed something I instantly mistook for a booby trap tripwire. I might walk on a spring day in an open field, admiring its budding trees and smelling the flowers. A moment later, a helicopter might fly over, and I would be back in the war, looking intently for armed enemies among the trees, flowers, and bushes, alert to every move, color, or object that might threaten my survival. My remittent dreams of Vietnam are about being forced back into the war again and again. As well as intended as the response to Platoon seemed, in particular the sympathy toward the war's veterans, it was about 20 years too late. Facing up to Vietnam a dozen years after the war ended did not alter the fates of millions whose lives might have been preserved if the American people had acted sooner to stop the killing. The Vietnamese in the movie were accorded sympathy, but I seldom heard much response to what they suffered in conversations about Platoon. Concern was shown about the horror Americans underwent, but very little about the horror we caused. Four decades after Vietnam, we continue to be a nation obsessed with military power, engaged in a virtually forever war. We forget the bankruptcy of conducting our business in the world with arrogance and malice. Our own political liberties degenerate when we give power to generals and clerics and arrogantly belligerent chicken hawks. It is difficult to not laugh at the pious impostors who request our wealth and children for the abyss of military supremacy. The brother of an American soldier killed in El Salvador when the movie Platoon was in the theaters said it was unfair he died from a mortar explosion instead of being allowed to shoot it out with his attackers. Such an absurd remark, for while only in an era that forgets the horror of mechanized warfare, in which weapons sear, shatter, and hammer brains, bodies, trees, and rocks into sloshy pudding, yet ironically poignant in a nuclear age. Chuck Norris, a movie actor who profited enormously from distorting war in the same comic book fashion as Sylvester Stallone in his Rambo movies, criticized Platoon for its realism, claiming that America needed heroes. Perhaps those actors who furl their fables in patriotism should be made responsible for the tragedies they helped set in motion. We who returned from Vietnam probably should have sued John Wayne, as well as his scriptwriters, if for nothing more than for concocting the worst American war movie ever, The Green Berets. At the end of Platoon, I stared at the schmaltzy technique of flashing the faces of the actors on the screen, seemingly in imitation of the greatest war movie ever, the original 1930 All Quiet on the Western Front, which is said to be the last movie about World War I made by those who survived it, from the great book of the same name by Erich Maria Remarque, himself a survivor of that war on the German side a century ago. Yet I looked at those faces as if they were my old friends and that it would be the last time I would see them as they were then. I left the theater, which has itself been restored into something very different, thinking about what the announcer of the old Naked City television series used to say at the end of every episode. There are millions of stories in every war. Platoon has been one of them. And now, I would like, as an epilogue, Monday is the vernal equinox, and just as every spring the swallows return to a certain mission in California, public radio and television hold pledge drives to keep their wings flapping. KMUN is conducting its spring pledge drive this week. under the new political regime that has descended upon this country, it is more than ever necessary to trump the grotesque hobgoblins of hatred and fear. We are suddenly engrossed in an ideological world war in which the fairy tale script calls for white nationalist supremacist control of the West, particularly Europe and the USA, and to spread this malignancy to the East to suppress the illusory surge of heretical Islamic infection of Western civilization. The exploited deception that leaks from this mythology is moving rapidly to destroy diversity, democracy, and compassion in this country. The tools are fear and intimidation, empowered by political Darwinism. We seem to be quickly manipulated into a racially charged global religious confrontation that resembles the same clash of dogmas as in antiquity. Suppression of free thought is vital to this false theory. The late Supreme Court Justice William Brennan extolled the valiance of those, quote, in the pursuit of recognition and enforcement of the First Amendment. Fortunately, we have a lot of company. It isn't easy, but it is certainly worthwhile. And Andrew Jackson, whose 250th birthday was yesterday, and with whom fake populist Donald Trump pretends comparison. Jackson did drive Native peoples out of the United States, the infamous Trail of Tears. But Jackson also said, fear not, the people may be deluded for a moment, but cannot be corrupted. So call in your pledge for KMUN today. It is vitally necessary for public media to fill the void purposely disdained by commercial and corporate media. The anticipated dark era of intolerance, corruption, and domestic tyranny has been unleashed, which makes public media an absolute necessity for the defense of democracy, which also makes it a target to be eliminated. Pledge now. And I'd like to end this program with a poem written by Anna Myers, The Hands of War. The hands of war, hands dripping with blood, weapons of mass destruction, still missing. Hands of war, how many people die for power, for nations of the world? How many people die when we fight for peace? Hands of war, hands covered with blood, whose hands are cleaner than those fought the war of those or those of their leaders. And that was by Anna Myers, The Hands of War. She is a 2003 graduate of Astoria High School. She is an Agent Orange baby, grown up now, having contracted it from her Vietnam veteran father, who died when she was 18 months old. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy Vernality.